Well, welcome to this Ideas, LSE Ideas-sponsored event, one of our book launches this term, and I'm delighted to introduce our speaker. There were meant to be two speakers today, the two authors of the book. Unfortunately, Florence Gaub is in Jordan, very ill, so she hasn't been able to fly over for this event, but we're very happy that Rob Whale is here to present his case. The NATO case, or rather than his personal case. Rob is retired Major General, and he spent 5 years at NATO's multinational headquarters in Naples, but important for this event is that he was there for the planning of NATO's Libya intervention, which is the subject, of course, of the book, and he directed operations from the Joint Task Force in 2011, so there couldn't be anyone who's better qualified to tell you about this operation, which is may have been some years ago now, but is still as timely as ever because of the repercussions and the outcomes that came from it. And just to remind you, the Libya operation was a military success, unlike perhaps the operation in Afghanistan, which NATO has also been associated with. But it was also politically contentious from the beginning, with people like President Obama wanting to lead from behind and Sarkozy and Cameron wanting to lead from the front. And there was opposition, of course, inside NATO, quite vocal opposition, I think, at times from a number of NATO countries, but also, of course, support from a majority of NATO countries. Anyway, I'm not going to presume to anticipate what you're going to say. He will speak for 50 minutes or so, and then there will be a question and answer session afterwards. And when you ask your questions, please identify yourself and your affiliation. And then there will be a book signing. And I think some of you have already bought a book, but there will be a book signing at the end at 8 o'clock. So look forward very much to you.
I will acknowledge that I had a degree of personal discombobulation this morning when Florence sent me an email to say that she was no longer able to come. She's unwell in Jordan, and she sends her apologies. Which is a shame, least of all because I would like publicly to thank her for the work that she did to integrate the two halves that were bolted together last year to form the one. And it was really her work in integrating both of those elements last year that ended up with the cauldron. So sorry Florence is not here, but Christopher has agreed, thankfully, to any tricky political questions will be answered by him and not by me. Joke, yeah. And Florence would have covered, I think, the kind of the geopolitical backdrop of Gaddafi's September 69 coup, the overthrowing Idris, the consolidation of his leadership up until the point at which we NATO embarked on this operation. So I'm sorry for the fact that she's not here, but I will be touching inevitably on quite a few political issues, given the fact that like all conflicts, they have and are driven by politics, and none more so, frankly, even down at the level that I was sitting in Naples. What I want to do first of all, though, is to paint a bit of a picture to help you understand how the bits of this puzzle fit together. It's mainly about the key footprints. United Nations, I don't really have to explain, but the political entity within NATO is headquarters NATO, in the North Atlantic Council. Essentially, the point at which political decision-making on behalf of NATO is made as a consequence of inputs from the various capitals, from each of those nations. That in itself a very complex requirement of permanent representatives and military representatives, ambassadors et al., in headquarters NATO, to converse with their respective nations to articulate the political requirement. And in the case of NATO, also the dialogue that went on between headquarters NATO, that political entity, and the United Nations with the generation of two key United Nations Security Council resolutions, 1970 and 1973, and I'll come back to those. The bit below that, importantly, is the Supreme Headquarters Allied Powers Europe, hitherto, or forthwith I'll refer to as SHAPE. important because that's where the politics and the military strategy are bolted together. So whatever the political intent is articulated with the North Atlantic Council, that is translated by the Supreme Allied Commander of Europe in shape and is then creates, in effect, the strategy for the operation. So for Libya, one level down where I was at the joint headquarters as the planner for Libya, my day-to-day, almost hour-by-hour interaction was with the Supreme Headquarters, Allied Powers Europe. In Naples, in the joint headquarters, we created a combined joint task force, and it was that platform which effectively, with a Canadian three-star commander, commanded and controlled the operation for the seven-month duration of the operation. And then below that, we had the maritime, the air, special forces to a degree, and other entities that came under command of our headquarters. So I just want to convey that sense of almost immediately you'll understand, therefore, that the difficulty of converting political intent two or three layers up into an operation was highly complex, and it was made more so by the fact that the time that we had available to translate politics and strategy into an operational plan was seriously compressed into a period of about 3 weeks. I think I'll just make 3 points before I start with some additional context. The first is that one of the reasons why I wrote the book, bearing in mind it finished in 2011, I left the army in 2015, was that I was driven by constant conversation and public and political perception that NATO did it for Libya, that the current conflict that prevails in Libya at the moment was as a direct consequence and a continuation of NATO's intervention into Libya. In actual fact, and I think as Professor Christopher has alluded to, NATO's operation in Libya could, from a military perspective, be regarded as a success. I'm quite happy to get into Q&A on this as to why I might believe that is the case. And in fact, I hopefully have articulated it reasonably well in the book. My view is that Libya's descent into civil conflict was not the fault of NATO. It was the fault of the international community, who failed once again, even in the face of events post-invasion of Iraq and post-invasion of Afghanistan, to think beyond the end of the fighting peace, the conflict. And so, irrespective of the fact that a great deal of uncertainty prevailed over how long the conflict would prevail, and irrespective of the fact that in Naples, in the joint headquarters, and in the Supreme Headquarters, Allied Powers Europe, in shape, a lot of planning, a lot of thinking, and a lot of activity took place to think, what happens if the regime collapses and we need to rebuild the country, we, the international community? And so that failure to understand once again that there was a requirement to coalesce, to bring together an alliance or a coalition at the political, economic, social domains was a spectacular failure. And it was entirely predictable, therefore, that once NATO ceased to protect civilians, that the outcome was going to be a gradual descent into civil conflict. And so, plus the mem shows, I would suggest, are particularly frustrating after the lessons that have been learnt in Iraq and in Afghanistan. This manifestation was, I think, further exacerbated by the fact that NATO agreed an end state, which in broad terms read measures to protect civilians of a wider threat of attack were no longer required. So from a NATO perspective, as far as we were concerned, and all the planning that we did and the operations that were focused on the protection of civilians, and I'll come back to that in the context of responsibility to protect, all finished the minute that civilians were no longer needed protecting, which in the case of either capitulation of Gaddafi, the fall of the regime, the death of Gaddafi, or a combination of those factors, would mean that the vacuum would need to be filled relatively quickly. And it wasn't. My role in the Joint Headquarters in 2011 was to, in effect, capture the emerging strategy from SHAPE, to absorb dozens of additional planning staff that came from across the Alliance and arrived in Naples, and to generate a series of operational plans, which I'll come on to in a second. And it is the norm, generally speaking, in military terms, that if you are the planner, you finish the plan and you chuck it over the fence to the operator, and you say, good luck, mate, crack on, and I hope it all goes well, which I did. Unfortunately, in the time that it was traveling from the plan to operator, I was nominated as the director of operations, so I caught it on the other side, and therefore was then also responsible for running the operation for the subsequent 7 months, which did have some advantages. Least of all, I knew the nooks and crannies of the plan. But that did come as a bit of a surprise, but then also is one of the reasons why, apart from the very few people who served throughout the conflict, both in terms of the planning and then subsequently through the operation, very few people, probably no more than 10 or 15, have a real comprehensive understanding of the evolution of the operation as it unfolded from the cathartic moment when we got nominated by the SecGen on the 4th of March 2011 through to its culmination on the 31st of March 2011. If I stand back a little bit now, and you're probably going to get the impression that by the time I finish this, that how on earth did NATO manage to respond in the way that it did? And how can I possibly stand here and claim that it might have been a military success when I line up all of the challenges that we faced in 2011? Some of which, these challenges, prevailed well before we even imagined that NATO would get involved in an intervention non-Article 5 of the Washington Treaty, that is not a collective defense, outside the NATO area in North Africa. And the fact was, and I saw this in 2010, and I remember exercising a degree of anxiety with the command group in Naples in the Joint Headquarters, NATO was manifestly unprepared to deal with an operation like Libya because it had spent the best part of 15 years either in peacekeeping or in peace enforcement or in counterinsurgency. So throughout, really, the end of the Cold War, where NATO collective defense was writ large, albeit very binary, Warsaw Pact versus NATO, the minute the wall came down and we entered into the Bosnia conflict, the Kosovo conflict, predominantly peacekeeping, but a bit of peace enforcement, and then subsequently counterinsurgency, we stripped away a lot of the more conventional requirements that we needed to undertake and which were placed in our laps for Libya, the most profound of which was targeting. And I'm going to cover a bit of targeting a little bit later, so you get a feel for some of the challenges related to how targeting evolved and how it was we found ourselves at the beginning of this operation, which was to protect civilians with many, many aeroplanes contributed by many nations and amphibious and maritime task forces, with only one targeting officer who was trained in the Joint Headquarters. No process, no procedure, no technology, zero. And yet we were about to enter into an operation in which targeting fundamentally lay at the center, and good targeting lay at the center of the protection of civilians. In addition to that, so we have a backdrop, which is NATO's configured to do peacekeeping, peace enforcement, and is engaged in Afghanistan on counterinsurgencies. The routine exercises, we see separation of maritime, air and land and special forces. We don't see any joint targeting whatsoever in any of these exercises. So the backdrop to a switch into an operation like Libya, whatever the set of circumstances that prevailed at the time in Brussels or in Naples, was going to be pretty challenging. And in addition to that, sitting where I was as the planner in the joint headquarters, we had done no planning at all for the time that I was there, which was 1 year before Libya started, with our strategic headquarters. And yet, we were being asked, at the time that we kicked off in March 2011, to have established sufficient communication, collaboration, and a rapport to be able to write 4 operational plans, which were reflected at the strategic level, at significant pace, having never worked together before. Fortuitously, and by coincidence, and not by design, there was a small planning exercise in January, February of 2011, which spawned a degree of what I describe relatively positive communication with our strategic planners in Brussels. Remember, so we're dislocated anyway, and with the planning team in Naples. So, and by the way, we finished that exercise, small exercise, on the 25th of February, and then on the 4th of March, so only a number of days later, we received the notification from the Secretary General that we were going to undertake the planning for Libya. And so by that stage, the Arab Spring had kicked off. And this is, I'm now talking about the 4th of March. By that stage, United Nations Security Council Resolution 1970 had been signed off, which in effect was freezing Gaddafi's assets, prevented movement, et al. And it was the first sign that the United Nations were beginning to think about responsibility to protect. And if I just give you a definition of that, for those of you that are not familiar with the doctrine of responsibility to protect, it really emerged as a consequence of the Rwanda genocide, Kosovo, Srebrenica, 2005 or thereabouts, so it's about 4 or 5 years after Kosovo, in the United Nations was this notion that it would enable the principle that the first obligation of an individual state was to protect civilians, and that the international community would thereafter also, and if necessary, in support if the individual state failed, to protect civilians from genocide, war crimes, ethnic cleansing, and crimes against humanity. And so quite a lot of preamble before the 4th of March, which were indicators that NATO might have become involved. But I can tell you, at the time of the beginning of March, there was absolutely zero indication that NATO would be undertaking an operation in less than 1 month later. Albeit the fact on the 4th of March, we found out that the Supreme Headquarters Allied Powers Europe, with Jim Stavridis, who was then Supreme Allied Commander Europe, had been doing some prudent thinking and prudent planning for the best part of 2 weeks. They just didn't tell us that they had been doing it. So on the 4th of March, we started planning. We had limited understanding, coordination, and synchronization with our Supreme Headquarters. We had no components who had been nominated, that is, the maritime, air, or land forces. And I only had approximately 15 individuals working in the operational planning group. By about 5 days later, we had somewhere in the region of 150 people had reinforced the planners in Naples, and off we went for a period of about 3 weeks. And we started with humanitarian assistance on the basis that the United Nations were concerned about the level of violence and the efflux of refugees out of Libya that the UNHCR, Airtel, and other UN agencies and non-government organizations would be able to deal with the numbers that were coming out. So we started writing that in conjunction with some of our partners, in addition to a maritime embargo, which is the prevention of movement of weapons and ammunition et al., and a no-fly zone. But in essence, we were planning in a vacuum. And so this was the next problem, was that Gaddafi was and had been deemed to be, thought to be the good guy. There was very little intelligence on the state, the economy, social dimension, the politics, or indeed his military, which was rapidly fracturing between the pro-Gaddafi forces and the anti-Gaddafi forces. So we had very little understanding of the evolution, which was very rapid, that was taking place in Libya, which is not a good place to start if you want to produce operational plans that subsequently are going to drive the operations. So no or little intelligence, made more complex by the fact that each of the nations were holding on to their intelligence, the US, the UK, the French. There was this thing called Five Eyes, United Kingdom, Canada, United States, who were sharing intelligence. But that was about as far as it went. So not only poor understanding, little intelligence, but nobody was sharing that intelligence either. So attempting to write plans, four of them, of which in the end two were endorsed by the North Atlantic Council, that is a maritime embargo, and then subsequently the no-fly zone to protect civilians, I'll come back to that in a second, was pretty challenging. And it was only by virtue of lifting the lid on a number of intelligence agencies that we began to build a reasonable comprehension of what was going on in Libya, such that we were able to commence with the planning and turn that into an operation. Let me just return to the responsibility to protect. Forged in the United Nations, translated into United Nations Security Council Resolution 1973 to protect civilians, in which a number of key constraints were placed and translated by the North Atlantic Council in the strategy, and we had to adopt, retaining, I would like to believe, in fact, I would strongly believe, the integrity of responsibility to protect from the doctrine through to the operation itself. For example, no boots on the ground. So NATO was told right from the start that there would be no occupation force, which didn't necessarily mean there wouldn't be forces on the ground, nor necessarily that they wouldn't be operating in support of NATO, but NATO said there would be no boots on the ground. And if they were, they would be national only. And that we were not, that is NATO, and where we were sitting in Naples, to have any form of communication whatsoever with the forces on the ground. I'm happy to return to that later in questions if you want to quiz me on that, because there were some nuances there. Second big thing was that the collateral damage that we were given was very, very tight. No buildings, no bridges, no roads, which, if you take into account what happened in Iraq and what was happening in Afghanistan, was significant for us because it seriously constrained the extent to which we would be able to undertake a targeting operation. That was also allied to another severe constraint, which was we were told there would be no civilian casualties. So into the targeting regime was this notion that if there was expectation of injuries to or death by the civilian population, then we could not hit that target. And in the end, two-thirds of the targets that we had on our targeting database could not be used as a consequence of that constraint alone. So only 30% of the targets could be used on the basis that the other 70 or so might incur injury or death to the civilian population. So what I'm doing here is I'm mounting up all of these constraints at the time when we're still not sure that we're going to be in the mix as an operation. We've got a lot of inertia in the headquarters. It's multinational, and a lot of people think there's no way in a million years that NATO is going to undertake this operation. It's just not going to happen. So imagine our surprise, therefore, when United Nations Security Council Resolution 1973 was endorsed, and the coalition led by the Americans under Operation Odyssey Dawn struck targets in Libya on the 19th of March in the wake of that United Nations Security Council resolution, with a very clear message that came from President Obama and whistled through NATO, arrived in Naples, which was the US is gonna lead from the rear. We are no longer gonna run this operation, by which stage NATO had been selected, because there were other options to this, as the alliance of choice to run an operation forged in R2P under responsibility to protect, for the protection of civilians, and that we would take over from that coalition, which was pretty mighty, because actually it was predominantly US, and they were focusing on air defense, they were focusing on command and control, and strategic targets. We would take over from that coalition on or around the 31st of March, and we were just fundamentally unprepared for this. We had no targeting process. We had no targeteers. We actually had no headquarters that could command and control, because the campus in Naples was a mile long and half a mile deep. So we effectively had to equip a building out to exercise command and control, which took 6 days and actually wasn't completed until we had taken control of the operation, particularly the no-fly zone. So all of that put together placed NATO, I will tell you, in the most perilous position. And I to this day, don't really understand how it is we managed to get through the first couple of weeks, 3 weeks of March, having transitioned from a coalition to NATO. Again, never practiced before. That was really, really ugly. Taking control of the air, maritime space, to undertake a mission to protect civilians, in which the intelligence was low, there was no targeting process, and then to make matters worse, Etna kicked off, threw ash into the sky, which limited the space, aerospace available to planes to fly, and the weather over North Libya was absolutely shocking. All of which was to Gaddafi's advantage. And at a time also when, cleverly, because this is what you do if you're an adversary, he transitioned most of his forces, I'll call them pro-Gaddafi forces, from military vehicles into civilian vehicles with crew-served weapons, that is, with rockets, machine guns, etc., on the back of white fleet vehicles. And he did that because he knew that in our rules of engagement, we could not strike civilian vehicles. So, and this one, this particular issue played out for a number of days, if not weeks, as we all oriented and understood the fact that Gaddafi had, unbeknown to us and cleverly, and this wasn't the only example, had adapted to a situation making our life somewhat complex. So we took over from the coalition. We had a very difficult march. All sorts of things were going on the ground. Benghazi was held predominantly. That was as a consequence of the coalition operation. But in the east, Ajdabiya and Brega were constantly under threat. There was a siege in Misrata in the center, north, which went on pretty much all the way through to July. How on earth those Libyan forces managed to hang on, and that's the anti-Gaddafi forces, for the period of time that they did, but it was also a focus for sustained operational joint action by NATO as well. And if you looked at the map in March and April at what constituted anti-Gaddafi forces and that territory held by non-regime forces, it was virtually nothing. Berber Highlands in the west, Misrata in the center, and in the east it was Benghazi, Tobruk, and Ajdabiya. And so off we went to protect civilians. And the key point here that I would like to make is that linked to the protection of civilians was the fact that every single mission that was undertaken by NATO air and maritime forces was done so with the key effect to protect civilians, i.e. unless there was a causal link between the threat, either a real threat or the threat or the threat of harm, and the protection of civilians, then the target would not be struck. So, for example, we did know where some of Gaddafi's key personnel were, and I'm talking about the leadership. We did not strike them on the basis that unless they were inciting violence, then they did not represent a legitimate target, crafting in also the whole issue of international humanitarian law, law of armed conflict, proportionality, necessity, and distinction, and all those other complex elements that go into a targeting requirement. So we didn't hit the roads. We wouldn't hit the buildings. We would not strike a target, and to great credit to the Air Forces, would not strike a target unless there was a defined, clear, and tangible threat to the civilian population. And as a consequence of that, again, linked to zero civilian casualties and a low collateral damage estimation, meant that many targets were left perceived targets that were left to fight another day until such time as they presented a credible threat to the air forces and the maritime component. On intelligence, the quality and the timeliness of intelligence started to build very quickly. One of the issues that we, and I mentioned that we had to resolve very quickly, was to gain intelligence fusion, not just to be able to build our comprehension of the picture in Libya, but then also to furnish the targeting. And by about April, I think I would like to say we had sufficient stability to do a number of things. We had built a targeting process, so finally we had the people. Finally, we had the process, the procedures, and we had the technology. We understood more about the way that anti-Gaddafi forces, because we were watching them in case they were threatening civilians, and pro-Gaddafi forces were evolving. We understood some of the techniques that they were beginning to use by parking vehicles next to the great man-made waterway, river, by next to buildings and roads to try and prevent them being targeted. And a switch, therefore, by the combined air forces for precision strike. Very low collateral damage, causing virtually no casualties except the focus of the target, which meant that, and I'll come on to the statistics shortly, that the overall number of civilian casualties, although I would not stand here ever and claim that they were zero, were, given the number of sorties and the number of strikes that took place, relatively low. In fact, only 13 instances of civilian casualties were cited in the aftermath of the operation. A couple of other points about this. First is that, so we had no direct comms with the rebels. We were unable to talk to the anti-Gaddafi forces, and nor we were mandated able to talk to the other military forces that we all know were operating in Libya. I'm not at liberty to talk about that in any detail, except to say that if you've got a bunch of rebels, most of whom are not militarily trained, and special forces that are running around Libya, it makes life difficult in terms of deconfliction, and then also knowing where some of these forces were operating and what their intent was. And as days and months went by, it became more difficult to differentiate the anti-Gaddafi forces from the pro-Gaddafi forces. The other point I'll make before I then go on to some statistics and show you, give you a bit more of a flavor of how the targeting went, was that strategic communications within NATO came into direct conflict with national strategic communications. And what I mean by that was that we were absolutely clear what our role was, what our purpose was, which was to protect civilians. And it was our sole focus on every single targeting board that we undertook, which permeated down through to courageous restraint to the air component and to the maritime component. But the nations were all talking about regime change. Number 10, the White House. Versailles were constantly referring to regime change, which was an absolute counter in strategic communications messaging and narrative to the one that we were attempting to convey, which made life incredibly difficult for us. And I'd be more than happy to answer a couple of questions on that. Okay, so here's some of the statistics, which by any standard, and if you ever had the opportunity to have a look at the scale and the intensity of bombing and targeting in the early days of Iraq and in Afghanistan, I think significant credit to the air forces that the collateral damage sustained in Libya was virtually zero. The odd building was targeted mainly because it was being occupied by regime forces. And that 8,500 strike missions, there were only approximately 13 instances of, or alleged instances of civilian casualties. Part of that was because we did a thing called pattern of life. And I'll give you a very good example to highlight the extent to which the Air Force attempted to avoid civilian casualties. In the center of Tripoli or thereabouts is the Bab al-Azizir compound, which was Gaddafi's refuge, underneath of which were a number of very significant command and control bunkers. So we knew where they were. We knew what they constituted. They were exercising command and control over fielded forces, and we were listening to some of their communications. What Gaddafi did was to put a fairground smack over the top of the Bab al-Azizir command and control compound, because he knew that if he did that, we would not strike it. And indeed, we didn't. And so the only way, and this was a very important target from the point of view that Gaddafi was able to exercise very effective command and control from this bunker. So we put a drone, in layman's terms, over the top of this bunker, and we monitored the progress, or otherwise, of that target for a number of days. In fact, it turned out to be a number of weeks. The fairground moved 200 meters and turned into a 24-hour film studio, and in so doing, gave us the opportunity to strike that target. So I won't tell you what went in there, but three reasonable-sized munitions went into the C2 bunker, destroyed it, and the television screen in the film, because I've seen the video, shook a little bit, and the people went running around wondering what was going on, but no civilians were killed or injured as a consequence of that strike. And there are many examples that I could give where longevity, persistence, and pattern of life paid off in terms of reducing the likelihood of civilian casualties. Let me finish off, because I'm now, I think, at about nearing 45 minutes. Let me finish off with some challenges, and then I'll leave the strategic insights up there, if I may. In the multinational world, the nations have red cards. The stuff that they'll be prepared to do and the stuff that they'll not be prepared to do. And in many regards, the red cards from nations created more friction and anxiety, particularly in the early days of the mission, than anything else. So in addition to the agendas and what I call the reverse transfer of authority, capabilities leaving NATO, undertaking autonomous national missions on behalf of national interests, and then coming back into NATO, sometimes without being told. One example I can give is a target in Brega that had been engineered, if you like, for a deliberate strike precision, in which a nation with a naval gunfire targeted that with 150 rounds of 100mm munitions, which was against all of the conventions of targeting and precision strike. And they did that because they removed a ship out of NATO command struck the target and then basically put it back under command again. But of course, the consequences of that were not that that nation had struck that target, but that NATO had. And so in the multinational context, these red cards agendas and the reversal of command and control can be very negative. Many of the lessons learned from Afghanistan and Iraq were that, and Petraeus was brilliant in this, in the day that he arrived in Iraq, in Baghdad, where he said, we're no longer going to kill civilians, we're going to protect civilians. He completely turned the principal focus for undertaking a counterinsurgency from killing the insurgents to protecting the civilians. Now, if in protecting the civilians, we need to kill insurgents, then, and they are legitimate targets, then okay. But then it wasn't all about killing and bombing. It was also about influence and exerting influence by means other than the use of kinetic weapons. And we had this dilemma throughout the whole of Libya on what was the balance between exerting influence on anti-Gaddafi and pro-Gaddafi forces by the use of non-kinetic munitions, i.e. the blend of lethal with non-lethal. And I, to this day, cannot stand here and say to you that we could measure how well we did on the non-lethal side. So we're talking leaflets, of which there were roughly 12 million that were dispatched from aircraft over northern Libya, or by broadcast from aeroplanes or by other means. I can tell you the effect of bombing on hearts and minds, although we were very careful about protecting civilians. And we definitely know the effect that that's had in Afghanistan and Iraq in terms of the perpetuation of insurgents. And so this is a really, really difficult area, is the balance between non-lethal and lethal strike. But we did as best as we possibly can to use non-lethal where we could. If it was simply a question of persuasion, of using non-kinetic means to change people's perceptions, to reduce ultimately the number of casualties. The final challenge we had, when all was said and done on the 31st of October, when we turned the lights out for the last time in the operations room, was that the International Commission of Inquiry on Libya, the ICIL, set up this inquiry mainly to focus on both the anti- and pro-Gaddafi forces, but they did a big chunk of inquiry on NATO as well. And it spawned a whole series of inquiries from New York Times, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, it goes on and on and on, which led to a six-month period of intense investigation on every single strike that NATO undertook, but more importantly, those 13 alleged instances of civilian casualties. And a lot of lessons were learnt in terms of keeping a record of civilian casualties, either through allegation, through media, and then also holding information at one's disposal in a portal to be able to search for the information and answer some of these really difficult questions. It took 6 months, in effect, to answer every single question that came our way in Naples, and this was therefore well after the operation had finished. So the strategic insights, I think probably I've covered most of these. We like to believe, I'd like to believe, we went well beyond the requirements that are enshrined in international humanitarian law, law of armed conflict, given the what we perceived at the time to be the constraints that were placed upon us by the United Nations, by headquarters NATO, and by SHAPE. In effect, it completely shaped the way in which we undertook the targeting for the full 7 months of the operation. Regime change is juxtaposed with NATO's operation the whole time. We had a policy in the Joint Task Force that if anybody mentioned regime change, they were instantly expelled from the headquarters. NATO NATO's view, certainly from our foxhole, if you like, was not about regime change, but it was severely attenuated, that message of protection of civilians, by what the nations were saying on pretty much every corner of the globe. And then this end state created a conundrum. We knew that if the end state was that we no longer needed to protect civilians, that there would be a penalty to be paid if nobody was going to plan for and subsequently coalesce the international community to deal with the aftermath of the operation. And that, to an extent, is also then linked to my final point on the integrated approach, which was the extent to which we were operating with and integrated with non-government organizations, with other entities that would constitute some semblance of hope for Libya in the aftermath of the conflict to rebuild it and have a prosperous, hopefully secure nation, did not happen at all. So same mistake as we saw in Iraq, same mistake as we saw in Afghanistan, which to this day remains a tragedy. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you very much. I'm going to open it up to the audience, but can I just start with a criticism that might be made, that you were so focused on the consequences of the tactics, particularly with regard to collateral damage, that you lost sight of the consequences of the strategy, and that regime change, whether legitimate or illegitimate, was at least a political aim. Which I think is important here, because by having all the fighting on the ground, with a few exceptions of special forces, done by rebels, they had strategic aims that were counter to those politically in terms of values of the alliance that was actually fighting on their behalf.
Cheeky little question. Thank you, Christopher. So I wouldn't disagree with you. I mean, my counter to that would be from a number of angles. The first was, of course, we were interested in, but were not exerting strategic influence. So at our level, I'm not suggesting for 1 minute that we were focused entirely in and down. But what I can tell you is that once the operation got underway, our strategic headquarters above us had very little day-to-day, week-to-week contact with us, and we were attempting to drive them at the strategic level and the North Atlantic Council to think about the problem related to what happens if there is a regime collapse, capitulation, and who's going to deal with the aftermath. And there was always this notion in the back of our mind that we were going to find it very difficult to separate the requirement to effectively protect civilians without coming to the point at which we had done that to the extent that the regime no longer existed, and in the case of the 20th of October, when Gaddafi died, mercifully not at the hands of NATO, tragically by other forces, that our prediction came to pass. R2P, the protection of civilians, suddenly became fused with the idea that the natural consequence of that would be a regime change. So, and the strategic narrative held, interestingly enough, the strategic communications held at the highest level in NATO, within headquarters NATO, was sometimes at odds with our own, and definitely at odds with the nations. And so to the lay person who was watching all of this unfold, they would not unnaturally have been very confused as to whether this is about regime change, or they might not even heard about the protection of civilians.
Okay, thank you. Right, let me open it up. And if you could just identify yourself at the same time. Yes. We have a microphone, I think, going around, so...
Thank you very much for a very interesting presentation. Andreas Binke, University of Reading. You seem to suggest that NATO came to the conclusion not to be in the business of regime change by itself, But surely, at least that's what I recall, it is a reflection on that the United Nations authorization of the intervention did not include regime change. So in a sense, you find yourself bound by that as NATO here. And then individual governments all of a sudden find this whole thing exceedingly sexy and sort of level it up. So is that the case? Is this a reflection of the authorization and the non-authorization of the regime change in there? And secondly, supposedly Russia and China have an issue with this intervention by NATO because they feel duped because all of a sudden it ends up in regime change. So could you briefly elaborate a little bit on the consequences of this in the larger context of diplomacy for NATO and its relationships with Russia and China?
Yeah. So I suspect, in fact, I think I know, that the, if you like, the legitimacy and the validity of responsibility to protect has been seriously undermined as a consequence of the Libya operation. And I was asked this question the other day by an individual who is undertaking a PhD on R2P using Libya as a case of academic study. That said, how do you manage to retain the integrity of a doctrine like responsibility to protect, which may or may not be enshrined in a United Nations Security Council resolution, and in which is then translated by the political headquarters, in this case in headquarters NATO, and then by the Supreme Headquarters Allied Powers Europe, and then by Joint Headquarters, and then by the components, and to the task forces, and to the individual airplanes and boats. And the answer is with huge difficulty, because at any point in that chain, from idea R2P through to a UNSCR, to the point at which missiles are being delivered or guns fired, is a very, very long and tenuous chain, which is why, in my view, and to answer that first question, is that we absolutely took our from an operational design perspective, our guiding light was the UNSCR 1973 under R2P, and we attempted as best as we possibly could not to veer away from that. And so by very virtue of, for example, and I haven't mentioned it in my pitch, drafting an operational design around which the key conditions in there were related to the protection of civilians, meant that there was a constraint in activity terms placed on the maritime and the air forces not to veer away from that. So hopefully that answers your first question. And your second one, sorry, just to...
Just comment on the repercussions in relation.
Yeah. Well, I think, I mean, to everybody's surprise, I think we would say that their abstention on UNSCR 1973, was a big surprise, to the extent that I think at that moment when the UNSCR 1973 was endorsed, everything, and that was on the 17th of March, everything picked up very quickly. That was the moment when we realized we were probably going to take this operation on and the coalition were going to deploy. I would imagine very soon after NATO took control of that operation, the Chinese and the Russians rued the day that they had abstained and not vetoed 1973. And a question that I got frequently asked in a number of engagements I had in 2012 was, okay, Libya, but why not Syria? That's another massive question. But so you undertook an R2P for Libya. Why not for Syria?
Brother, yeah.
It's really a follow-up to this question, which is no doubt the question you were expecting to be asked anyway, over and over again in different ways. But the bit I didn't understand, I saw this entirely as a layman. I was actually sitting, I was aware of it, and I was still working for the EU at the time, but I was not involved at all. But the thing that puzzled me was not what you did, but what the governments did. The governments, having got a Russian and a Chinese abstention on a resolution like this, I would have expected them to have been as scrupulous as you were in ensuring that the terms of the regulation of the resolution were rigorously followed. So how was it that people went after Gaddafi, though I suppose he was a military target because he was a colonel? Nevertheless, if it was not supposed to be about regime change, why on earth were they doing regime change?
So I can assure you emphatically that Gaddafi and his close circle were not targets by NATO.
Not by NATO.
So there were other forces on the ground who might have had an interest in dealing with Gaddafi, but in reality, nobody knew where Gaddafi was for a period of about 4 or 5 months. There were tales that he had escaped Libya, that he wanted to stay in Tripoli. In reality, he probably almost certainly went back to his birthplace in Sirte. Whatever opportunities were afforded to those folk who were running around on the ground, of which there were a number of nations, whatever opportunity was afforded to them, I suspect was very, very small. He was off the radar completely. And it's interesting, I think, to note, again, as a little vignette here, that on the 19th of March, our headquarters received a report that an Amazonian bodyguard had been apprehended in Sirte. That was the first indication, and it wasn't a particularly reliable piece of intelligence, but it was the first indication that we had that Gaddafi might be in Sirte, and which, as a consequence of that, we increased the air presence over Sirte, and the kind of the rest is history, because I think without that having happened, it's quite possible that Gaddafi would have found his way out of, if not out of Libya, then maybe to Bani Walid, and then subsequently left, which would have presented a problem from a whole number of aspects. But I don't recall there ever having been a discussion that Gaddafi per se was being targeted by military forces, certainly not by NATO. And I can't really speak for special forces now. There, Saif, who got on the blower, his mobile phone, and attempted to direct fielded forces in the area of Sirte by mobile phone, suddenly became a legitimate target because he was inciting violence and directing fielded forces against the civilian population along the lines of kill those rats and the normal thing that his old man was speaking about. And we picked those signals up and we targeted him. Now, we missed him. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, I don't know. But I mean, the fact is that he was then and at that stage a legitimate target. So again, from my perspective, we drew the distinction very, very clearly between the proportionality distinction, necessity, the law of armed conflict, IHL, and protection of civilians. What others were doing on the ground, I know for a fact were at divergence to that approach.
On the Chinese and Russian thing, I mean, I think the Russian story is that Putin took his eye off the ball and then was furious with Medvedev for what happened. But it's difficult to imagine Medvedev doing anything without checking with Putin first. There's a question over there.
I think in 2016, the House of Commons Foreign Affairs Committee released a report. I don't think you mentioned it in your lecture, and I don't think the report itself is in the bibliography of your book, but given that it completely contradicts everything you've basically just said, I just wondered what you made of the report.
Well, so my counter to that is it's interesting that in that report, NATO's not mentioned once, and yet NATO was commanding and controlling the operation. So I'd throw that straight back at you and go, there was a view in London that the United Kingdom was front and center of this operation. And yet, the overall number of air sorties flown and weapon strikes by the United Kingdom was 12% of the total. The extent to which the UK militarily was influential in this operation is actually quite insignificant. And so I read that, I saw that, I know who was interviewed, and at no stage, depressingly, and I would suggest rather arrogantly, was there any acknowledgement that NATO was commanding and controlling that operation? Any response on that one?
Yeah. Actually, can we just remind you, if you can, just introduce yourselves? It would be very useful.
Hugh Sanderman, LSE Ideas. I'd like to follow up on that question about the House of Commons report, because it made another assertion that would be useful for you to comment on, which was that possibly civilians may not have needed protection from Gaddafi immediately after the defiance in Benghazi. And I wonder if you could comment on that.
Okay. So this is kind of a counterfactual issue, I would suggest, and we talk a little bit about this in the book. What happens, or what would have happened if either the coalition or NATO had not intervened? And you know what? I don't know the answer to that question. And Florence and I talked a lot about this. There've been lots of discussions as to what may have happened, for example, if the French hadn't gone into Benghazi on the 19th of March. What happens if the coalition hadn't done what they did for a period of about 9 or 10 days? With regard to command and control and enemy air defense. But I would be reticent to suggest that if NATO had not intervened post the transition from coalition to the alliance, that Gaddafi would not have continued to persecute and to threaten civilians that, let's face it, at that time were still holding in some numbers eastern Libya. So that included Benghazi, it included Tobruk, and most of eastern Libya, certainly Ajdabiya, which kind of went backwards and forth, Misrata, and the Berber Highlands. Gaddafi did everything in his power to try and wipe out the Berbers on that northwest part of Libya. And whilst I can claim legitimately that we, NATO, air and maritime forces, found it incredibly difficult in the early stages, that once we had the intelligence and we had the surveillance and reconnaissance, and therefore the eyes and ears, that there were many, many examples I could cite. I could sit here all day and tell you about the examples where civilians were still being killed. To what number? I don't know. So I think it would be interesting to undertake a counterfactual analysis of that to determine whether or not, if we just hadn't turned up, what would have happened thereafter.
Sorry, there's one in the middle. Yeah, and you'll be next.
Thank you for the talk. So the official name of the intervention was the...
Sorry, if I could just...
Can't really hear you.
Introduce yourself as well. Can you just say who you are?
Yeah, Dario, LSE students. Well, the official aim of the intervention was the protection of the civilians, but I was wondering that if maybe in your opinion the intervention could be seen as the NATO's fears of the possible negative international consequences of Gaddafi's domestic problems, and therefore if the intervention as a whole could be considered as a certain sort of risk management exercise, so preventive war, no boots on the ground, and so on. Thank you.
Woo, okay.
But I think this question is about, is it whether there would be massive migration if there were to be a large-scale violence inside Libya? Yes, so
yeah,
reaction in that sense.
Yeah. But, I mean, the fact was, I think, that tragically the intervention stimulated migration. It didn't prevent it. And so once Arab Spring kicked off, Tunisia... Libya, to a degree Egypt, but I think from Libya people were going east and west. There was a large number of internally displaced people and refugees that were moving out of Libya, and that frankly I think it is fair to say that as a consequence of the intervention, that situation only got worse. It didn't get any better. And that there are a number of examples where, particularly on the maritime side, where NATO is accused of ignoring its responsibilities under SOLAS, Safety of Lives at Sea, which is a UN convention and is a very important one, that was at the expense of conducting military operations under the United Nations Security Council resolutions. I'll be honest, I don't think anybody's really got to the bottom of the deaths, certainly, that occurred as a consequence of migrant ships sinking and people starving and whatever. And the extent to which, therefore, NATO disregarded its duty relative to SOLAS. But what I can say, I'm absolutely certain that the number of refugees increased as a consequence of the intervention. They didn't decrease. And of course, if you then, as a consequence of a conflict like that, are in a position where the security thereafter becomes less, not better, the politics are not joined up, and in effect you go into a low-level conflict and a civil war, it's only going to get worse.
Right. Did you want to come back specifically, Robert? Or... Okay, another question. Well, so we'll go there first.
Thank you so much for coming out tonight. My name is Joe Miller. I'm an undergrad here. My question's about leadership, I guess. So it sounds like you're implying that the civil conflict and then because of that, the refugee problem today is due to the what you referred to as the international community's maybe a collective action problem. And it also sounds like SHAPE was not prepared to pick up the pieces after R2P, after completing the military mission. So I guess my question is, who or what was best prepared to deal with the consequences of completing the R2P mission?
I think that's a really good question. And it was not absolutely that SHAPE ignored the requirement to think about or indeed to plan for what may happen in the aftermath of an operation. But we need to remind ourselves that NATO is a security organization. And so in that regard, it was possible, and indeed it was cited in the early part of the operation, should Gaddafi and the regime collapse, that NATO might be the organization to secure Libya in order to create the conditions for subsequent prosperity et al. Across political, economic, and social domains. But what was abundantly clear right from the very start was that an irrespective of the fact that there was no institutions of state in Libya, was that if any force was going to go into Libya after the end of the conflict, it was not going to be NATO, and that it might have been the African Union combination, except the African Union were really, really upset by NATO's actions. Joseph Zuma kept on going into Tripoli. So the African Union relationship with NATO to this day remains fractured. It might have been an Arab League or whatever. So it wasn't going to be NATO. It might have been another alliance or a coalition of states, almost certainly probably Arab. So there was congruence in terms of ethnicity and religion, et cetera, et cetera. But that only goes so far in terms of securing the nation and setting the conditions for subsequent rebuild. And of course, that's not SHAPE's responsibility. SHAPE, and actually more importantly, headquarters NATO, as the political footprint for NATO, attempted all sorts of initiatives to try and get the international community to coalesce around this problem post-conflict in order to rebuild, to reconstitute Libya, and tragically failed. Are you American?
Yeah.
So I mean, when I hear, for example, as I did to President Obama, blaming our erstwhile former Prime Minister and Sarkozy, that the problems in Libya now lie at the feet of Cameron and Sarkozy, is an interesting one, considering that really the US was sitting in the prime position to exert influence on international community writ large, to formulate a plan and to execute that plan in the aftermath of the Libya conflict. So he's rather, I believe, wrongly blaming Europe for a problem in which the U.S. failed to exert influence. So it's quite a long-winded answer, but it's a good question, that one.
So do you make that Obama statement sort of a virtue signaling step back from a world hegemon or unipolar power, while at the same time conducting, I think, clandestine missions that you might have referred to?
So, I mean, I think that the notion that that the U.S. was stepping back, an indication that came well before Obama was saying that the problem lies with Cameron and Sarkozy. Right from the very outset, and really it all came home after UNSCR 1973 was endorsed and the coalition went in, was a clear message that the U.S. was going to get out of there and was going to lead from the rear, and therefore NATO was going to step into the breach. But it is worth noting that actually the vast majority of air missions were still flown by the U.S. That includes the drones, refueling, and a lot of the strike missions that were there to deal with the air defense. So whilst, for sure, U.S. was leading from the rear, Obama was quite clear that you weren't going to be commanding it. It was Canadian who was commanding the operation. The U.S.'s role in support was significant to the point if the U.S. had not provided a lot of capabilities, then Libya just would not have happened.
And what about the report that Obama refused to do a cyber attack in the very early days on the grounds that he didn't want to be the United States to be the first country to attack another
cyber,
just shutting down the entire Libyan cyber capabilities. In the newspapers, it was reported at the time that was under discussion, and he ruled it out because of the risk of producing a precedent.
Yeah, and so, Chris, I'll be honest with you. I mean, we heard about that, but I have absolutely zero knowledge on what, if any.
Would it have helped or not?
I don't know. I don't think it would, actually. I don't think it would, from the point of view that once we were up and running, the one key provider of intelligence was by mobile phone and other communications equipment. So if that had all been shut off, I mean, of course it would have constrained Gaddafi and his forces, as it would have done the anti-Gaddafi forces as well. Shouldn't forget the role that they played. For sure it would have blinded us as well.
Okay, Robert, would you like to ask your question? No. Man, before that, I think the audience would be interested to know what your role was before we came to LSE.
Well, I worked for Javier Solana and people in Brussels. A curiosity of this was that actually the heads of government often seemed to be unaware whether they were meeting in NATO or the European Union, in that I think some decisions were actually taken on European Union premises, which they all thought was NATO at the time.
Yeah.
The thing that I find, that's weird, but the thing that I really find weird about this is that there doesn't seem to have been a strategic objective, because the objective that you were given to fulfill, and your account suggests that you did a very good job, it was a tactical objective.
Correct. And so there was no campaign plan. There was no campaign plan. There was no strategic objective which would have taken the predictable conclusion of a military campaign through to the rebuilding of a nation. That's absolutely right.
Yes, the war we used to be told was the pursuit of policy with an admixture of other means.
Yeah,
but I haven't spotted the policy yet.
There wasn't one. Yeah.
It's a very non-Clausewitzian campaign. Yes, there's one in the centre.
Another non-Clausewitzian campaign, regrettably.
To follow up on this, I mean, you said earlier that it wasn't NATO's responsibility to come up with a political objective or a strategy. Whose responsibility would it have been? And isn't, like, the whole doctrine of responsibility to protect incompatible with an intervention without a strategy and without the assurance of post-conflict stabilization?
Yeah. So on the first question, that where would responsibility or accountability lie for creating a strategy that takes the kind of the temporal horizon beyond just the completion or possible completion of a military operation? And I would be happy to take advice on this, but I would suggest the United Nations would probably, in theory, play quite a big role in this, and they did not. So the strategy within SHAPE could only, and within NATO could only go so far. The strategy was about a military institution consisting of an array of multinational contributions performing and operating up to a point in which the key requirement for the protection of civilians was no longer there. And beyond that, who's to say? UN were probably sitting in a pretty very reasonable place, particularly at the outset, because they were crafting and agreeing the United Nations Security Council resolutions. But it's possible that the African Union or the Arab League or a number of different coalitions might have stepped into that space. And so it comes back to my point about the extent to which I think responsibility to protect as an ethical, moral, and arguably legal argument in favor of an intervention to prevent genocide was severely undermined as a consequence of that failure to connect the requirement to complete a military endeavor with rebuilding a nation.